You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond, grassroots, listener-supported, that's very important, solar-powered radio broadcasting from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. My mother and co-host, Caroline Kilburn, is not able to be with us today, but she sure would like to have been because she really wanted to talk to our guest today. Our guest today is Michael Gruenbaum, who was born in 1930 in Prague, Czechoslovakia. In 1942, he was sent to the concentration camp, and I'm Terezin, with his mother and sister, and remained there until the end of the war. He emigrated to the United States in 1950, graduated from MIT and Yale, served 2 years in the Army, and worked for the Boston Redevelopment Authority and Massachusetts Department of Public Works before co-founding a consulting firm. He was married for 50 years to the late Thelma Gruenbaum, author with Michael of Nezerim, Child Survivors of Terezin. He has 3 sons and 4 grandchildren, and the title of his book is Somewhere There Is Still a Son. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Michael.
Thank you very much.
So this is a memoir of your childhood in Czechoslovakia, correct?
That is correct, yes.
And why now? Why did you write it now?
Okay. What happened was that my mother made an album of memorabilia from this camp that you mentioned. And when she passed away in 1974, I inherited that album. And then when I was closing in on a venerable age of 80, I thought to myself, I better do something with this. And I approached the Holocaust Museum in Washington, and in the end, I donated that album to them. Well, when the curator came to my house to pick it up, she couldn't believe her luck, because these days they get maybe one letter or one document, but here was a whole collection of documents and coupons and tickets and everything else. And so she was so thrilled, she took it back to Washington and presented it to the entire board of the museum, and they got all excited about it. And so I got caught in that excitement, and I decided to write a children's story narrating having the bear that saved our life, a stuffed bear that saved our life. I had him narrate the story. Well, for 2.5 years, I tried very hard to get somebody interested in publishing it, and I was getting nowhere. I wrote to every conceivable literary agent and publisher, and nothing. So then one day, out of the blue, I get a phone call from the editor of Aladdin Books, who said that, she asked me, would I entertain the idea of dropping the idea of writing a children's story, that they instead would send one of their writers to Boston to interview me. And they indeed did. For 3 days, the person stayed in my house, and the editor came from New York, and in the end, book got, the manuscript was published, and the book is here. So that's how it came about.
So Somewhere There Is Still a Son is written for young people to read, correct?
Well, you know, right now we have 41 reviews on Amazon about this book, and most of them are from adults.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, maybe only one or two are from teenagers, and all the adults say it's not just for teenagers, but it's for adults as well.
Well, that seems to be true of all of the best young adult fiction. It's just as, if not more, popular with adults. But it's great that it's written to be accessible for a younger reader also.
Absolutely, yes.
Because it's kind of easy for young people who maybe didn't know, you know, like my generation, my mother was born during the war. My grandparents, you know, were adults during the war. My former father-in-law was in World War II. And so there was still a lot of conversation about that time. for younger people today, that may not be true. They may not really be aware of everything that happened without books like this.
That is my experience as well. As I look around here in the Boston area and I come across, meeting the children of my friends, and they know nothing about this.
Wow.
You're absolutely right.
Now, did you talk about your experiences with your children when they were growing up?
You know, I did not. It took me a long, long time. You mentioned my wife's book, Child Survivors of Terezin. That was put together by interviewing the survivors of the, and my, you might say, bunkmates that lived with me in Terezin and who emigrated after the communists, when the communists took over, everybody sort of dispersed through the world. Out of the 80 kids, 80 boys that went through my room, and there were only 40 at a time, but because of transports that were being sent away, there were 80 boys, and out of those 80, 12 survived. And of those 12, two of them stayed in Czechoslovakia, and the rest dispersed through the whole world. Some in Australia, some in Brazil, some in Europe, Canada, United States. And so they were all over the place. And so...
How were you able to track them down?
Excuse me?
How were you able to track them down for your wife's book?
Well, there was one, especially one fellow who had a very high position in a major company in France, and he traveled throughout the world and kept track of everybody.
Mm.
And so we traveled 45,000 miles to interview everybody, and then my mother, my wife wrote this book. And anyway, your question really was, I forget now what your question was.
About whether you had talked to your own children about,
this. Okay. Well, I was the last one of the 10 people that my wife interviewed who told her my story, because I kept saying, well, I've already told you this, I've told you that. But it took a rainy day in the Swiss Alps when we had nothing to do. I said, well, okay, why don't you put the tape recorder on and I'll go over everything with you. And so that's what happened.
Wow. Michael, can you tell us where the title for this book came? Somewhere There Is Still a Son.
Yeah. Well, I will read to you, if you don't mind, and I can do it now, the letter that my mother wrote about 2 days after we were liberated. Is that a good point to do it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, okay. my mother, a couple of days after we were liberated, wrote a letter to some friends and relatives who had managed to escape the Nazis, and they were in Sweden and in Spain. And this is what she wrote. This is my first letter in which the threatening, indiscreet eyes of the censors do not know my thoughts. I do not know where to begin in order to describe to you without leaving anything out everything we have lived through during the years since we last saw each other. Each card, each package from all of you was a bit of warmth, a bit of the happy surroundings that we lost. I am writing to you as I remember you, and yet we have the feeling here that we will never be able to find a bridge to those who have lived on the outside and who fortunately will never be able to grasp what horror, fear, and deep sorrow we experienced through the years just past. We hardly have the hope of finding anyone of our relatives alive. We ourselves were saved by a miracle. We were collected for a transport 3 times. You can imagine the contrast between life and death. We look well, even though nourishment was very inadequate. To illustrate this, I want to tell you that the three of us, my sister, I, and my mother, the three of us consumed 3 eggs in 2.5 years, all of which we procured secretly. They cost about $6 apiece. Misha's sister worked on the laundry, and Misha was a delivery boy in place of a horse. He sometimes went to a friend with a notebook under his jacket to take some lessons. But it all failed because of the many obstacles and lack of time. We had to work 10 hours a day. We do not know yet how the future will shape up for us. None of our old friends are alive anymore. We do not know where we are going to live. Nothing. But somewhere in the world there is still a sun. Mountains, the ocean, books, small clean apartments, and perhaps again the rebuilding of a new life. So that's my mother's story, and she was certainly correct that we were able to rebuild a new life two years after we were liberated. You know, we went back to Prague, and then I had lost about 6 years of schooling. And anyway, when the communists were going to take over the Czech government, my mother managed to get a visa to the United States, but then we weren't able to enter the United States because there was a quota system on, and our quota number didn't come up for another 2 years, so we had to spend 2 years in Havana, where I went and finished high school, and I had to learn English, and I had to learn Spanish, and then it just so happened that I got, at the same time when our quota came up, I was able to enter MIT, where I had applied and got accepted. Mm. And that's where we started our journey in the United States.
What was it like living in Prague after the war?
The problem with that was that my mother had given a lot of our possessions to some friends and relatives and acquaintances for safekeeping. And when we came back from the camp, most people said, I don't remember that. I can't recall that you gave us anything. So that was not very pleasant, you know. But, it was something that we had to deal with, and it was a good thing that my mother had the foresight to, move out and start a new life. I mean, just imagine, she was 50 years old, and she decided to move to a completely new continent without speaking the language, without having a job, nothing. And so somehow we all managed, and we led a very good life here.
Did you have any friends or relatives to help you when you got to the States?
Well, my mother had my father's former employer who sent us the visas, and that essentially was it.
Mm.
I certainly didn't have any friends here.
Wow. You know, when you were writing, the beginning of the book, you're writing from the perspective of a very small child. You're about 8 years old, I think, at the beginning.
Yeah.
And it was amazing to me how much detail you seem to be able to recall from that time.
It's not that I remembered everything, but both Todd and I did a lot of research, for instance, about the edicts, what the Germans insisted on that we do before we were sent to Terezin, we had to wear a yellow star. Well, that's nothing new. Everybody knew that. But, of course, by wearing the yellow star, every time you went outside the building that we were in, there were bands of kids chasing me and pelting me with stones. So that was not very pleasant. And, we had a large apartment before the war, and we had a lot of artwork and books and oriental rugs, and we had a cook and a governess, and we even had a car. Very few people had a car in those days, but my father used it on the weekends only. So we had a good life, and then everything changed when the Germans came, and that's what I'm talking about, the edicts. We were not allowed to attend school. We were not allowed to go to the movies or concerts or play in the parks. We had to sit in the back of streetcars. We were not allowed to travel outside of Prague. We had to turn in with all the important things like jewelry and artwork and radios and skis and bicycles, musical instruments, cars, and so on. And all our bank accounts were confiscated. Our parents were not allowed to work. We couldn't associate with any non-Jewish friends. And we were allowed allowed to buy groceries only on certain days and certain hours, and we were allowed to buy only certain things. Like, we're not allowed to buy apples, you know. Mm-hmm. Here, we're talking about apples in the apple season mm-hmm. over here, but we're not allowed to do that. So it's a lot of these things I did not remember, but we did a lot of research for this book, and it was very helpful to us.
But it did seem like you remembered details about your own life from that time.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you know, there are certain things I remembered and certain things that came to me only when my co-author started writing and submitting things to me, and that jarred my memory. It's amazing how the memory works that way.
So your co-author was Todd
Hasaklovi.
Hasaklovi. And how long did you work with him?
Oh, it was just a few months, I would say.
Wow.
It wasn't very long. He did something that I never expected anybody to do. And I did not think that anybody who did not have the experiences that I had could really write about them. And he just immersed himself so well into the life of a 12-year-old living under the Nazi regimes. I couldn't believe it. As a result, I think the book is a terrific book.
So do I. And it's so readable. You know, it just draws you in and you want to know what happens. And of course, it's always because we know that this is your memoir and you're still alive. We know from the beginning that you didn't die, which is, I don't know if I could have read it without knowing that.
I see. Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because a lot of people have told me I started reading a book and I couldn't put it down.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people have said that.
Oh, absolutely. Amazing. Absolutely. Was it hard at all for you to relive all of that in order to write this?
Well, you know, it's funny because I keep thinking about a lot of these things daily. It's not something that I had to really dredge up. I'm so happy to be alive. You know, you notice the picture of me on the back cover of the book. There was a professor at the University of Texas in Austin who has made it a project for himself to go around, and he goes to Prague every year and takes pictures of survivors of Terezin. And he showed me some of the work he had done because he came to Boston to take pictures of the three survivors that are here in Boston. And I looked at the pictures. I said, listen, I don't want you to take a picture of me like that because they all look dour and glum. You know, and I said, I want a picture that makes me smile, shows me smiling because I'm very happy to be alive. And I went to take a picture of me holding the bear because it was a stuffed bear that saved our life. We haven't talked about that yet. But,
no. Do you want to tell us about your stuffed bear?
Yeah, sure. In October of 1944, the Germans suddenly decided that they were going to pretty much liquidate the Terezin camp, and they sent about two-thirds of the inmates on trains to what they called the East. Nobody knew what the East meant, but we all knew that nobody had ever come back from there. So the trick was to stay in Terezin, not to go on these transports. And we were on transports. We got the summons to be on a transport a couple of times before, but my mother was able to pull us out by going to the people that made these decisions and reminding them how much my father had done for the Jewish community in Prague, and so they pulled us out. But in October 1944, the people that had made these decisions were themselves transported away. Mm. So there was nobody to go to anymore. Well, we were in this transport. There were 11 transports of 1,500 people each, and our number in this particular transport was 1,350. So we had a high number. And that gave my mother enough time to pull another rabbit out of the hat, so to speak. She ran over to the place where she worked, which was the arts department, and she talked to the person in charge, who was Joel Speer, who was a very famous Dutch artist. And she told him, look, we got an order from the SS man in charge to make teddy bears for his children and his friend's children for Christmas, which was October. And so you better tell him that that order is not going to get filled because I'm being deported. So he went to the SS man, and he was very lucky that he was nearby. He found him and told him exactly what my mother said. And the SS man thought about it for a while, and he said, okay, pull her out. And the boss said, well, that's okay, but, you know, she has two children, and if they go, she will want to go with them. All right, pull them out as well, but nobody else. So my mother got a piece of paper from him saying that we were excused and ran over back to the assembly area, went to the desk, presented this piece of paper to the guy behind the desk, and he scratched us off the list. And my mother says, can we leave now? And he said, no, you can't leave yet. You have to go upstairs to the second floor and wait until the train leaves. So we had to go upstairs to the second floor, and we go open the door to the first room, and it was completely jammed. There's about 35 people in that room. We go to the second room, and the same thing. There were another 35 people there. We go to the last room away from the stairway, and there was some room there, and we were able to sit down and wait for the train to leave. Well, we were thinking that the next sound we would hear is the train leaving. Well, that did not happen. What happened was that there suddenly was a big commotion. The German soldiers came running up the stairs, yelling and screaming, the dogs barking like crazy. They opened the door to the first room and pulled everybody out of there because they needed 50 more bodies for the train. They opened up the door to the second room and pulled half of the people out of there. And we were sitting there in that third room, quiet as can be. You could hear a pin drop. Because we didn't want to attract any of the soldiers into our room. And after a while, we heard the footsteps again from the soldiers, but this time the footsteps were going away. And finally, the train left, and we were saved for another day. So that's my story about the teddy bear.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Michael Gruenbaum, author of Somewhere There Is Still a Son, a memoir of the Holocaust. Now, in your mother's letter, she also mentioned that you actually were supposed to be.
I was in the transport by myself.
Yes.
Right?
How did you get out of that one?
Again, my mother, for some one reason or another, she managed to get me out.
Wow.
Now, my mother was an amazing person.
Were there happy times with your mother and sister in Terezin, or was it all really difficult?
Well, what you have to understand is when we arrived in Terezin, the first thing that happened was that I was separated from my mother and my sister. I was sent to this building with that housed boys of my age, and I was put into room 7, and there were 40 other kids there. And so I did not get to see my mother on a daily basis. In fact, my mother... Well, the 40 boys that we had in that room were sort of governed by a teacher who was only 20 years old, but he was just a superb person. He managed to not only keep us out of trouble, but he kept us clean, and hygiene was very important there. And he taught us many things, and he brought in some of the professors that were there to teach us all about history and geography and so on. And so all that had to be done sort of undercover. You know, the Germans were not allowed. They were not allowing us to have formal education. But so we had to have somebody standing outside watching, making sure that no Germans were coming by. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this fellow did a superb job. And he, as a matter of fact, he emigrated to the United States and lived in the Los Angeles area and just passed away last year. He was over 90 now.
Wow. Were there any non-Jewish people who helped you or your family during this time?
No, none.
Wow.
Well, what you have to understand is that the way it worked is... most of the Jewish people from Czechoslovakia, we were being sent to this camp that we were in. Jersey, and 140,000 Jewish people were sent there. 90,000 of the 140,000 were sent in these trains to the east and perished, and most of them in the gas chambers in Auschwitz. And 35,000 died in Terezin itself from old age or malnutrition. So there were only about 15,000 or so that survived, and luckily we were part of that 15,000.
Now, you wrote about your nanny being very upset about what was happening early on. Did you ever see her after the war?
I don't recall that we really saw her. We may have seen her once or twice, but that was about it. She was standing there on the street waving to us when we were sort of paraded through Prague on the way to the assembly area before being put on the train to go to Terezin. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how she found out about it, but she was there and waved to us, which is in contrast to what happened with our cook, right? I think I wrote about that as well, where my father and I think, were walking on the street, and our cook was on the other side of the street, and I said something to my father, well, let's go over there and say hello to her. He said, no, because she obviously didn't want to have anything to do with us. Mm-hmm. At least she didn't want to be seen that she had anything to do with us.
Michael, have you been back to Prague since you left?
Yeah, I did not go back for 43 years. And I finally, the communists were overthrown in 1989, and I went back in 1992. Actually, what happened was my sister decided that she was getting old, and she was 4 years older than I was, and she wanted to go back to Prague even while the communists were still around. So she applied for a visa, and they gave her a visa. This was in 1987, 2 years before they were overturned. And so I said, well, if I'm going to go back, I might as well go with her. So I applied for a visa, too, and now suddenly word comes back, well, you have to send us $5,000 for your high school education before we can give you a visa. I said, well, I'm not going to do that.
Whoa.
So I didn't go. And as a matter of fact, my sister called up the Czech ambassador in Washington and said, why are you giving my brother such a hard time? And he said, you know what? I think we made a mistake in your case, so you better send us your visa back. So that's what happened. But we did go finally in 1992. We went together, and it was nice because she remembered very clearly where my grandparents used to live and everything about that village, which I did not know.
Did anything...
The interesting thing was that in 1991, when I first came back, I brought my three sons and my wife, and I had rented a car, and we drove in from Frankfurt, and I drove into Prague, and I knew exactly how to go, and nothing had changed. After 43 years, I remembered exactly the street pattern.
And it was all familiar?
It was all familiar, wow. Right, exactly.
Wow. So how did it feel to be there as an adult after all of this and after everything that happened? Do you feel any bitterness towards the people?
Well, I wouldn't say bitterness. No, I just sort of, you might say, I stayed away from them, you know. I went there because I wanted to show my kids and my wife what Prague was like, and I drove them around and things like that. And I had one, I can tell you one little story, which is that my best buddy from Terezin stayed in Czechoslovakia. And I corresponded with him at the very beginning. And then I stopped corresponding with him because I didn't want him to get into trouble. Under the communists, it was not a good idea to be getting letters from the United States. So I stopped. But when the communists were overthrown, I managed to find him through another friend, and I told him that I might be coming. And you know what he did? He invited me to his apartment and gave me his bed.
Oh.
Isn't that something? After 40 years.
Yes, it is.
I couldn't believe it.
Yes.
That's what happened.
Wow.
That's how strong, you know, the relationship was.
Your odds of survival were so low. Were you aware of that at the time?
No. No. First of all, I was a kid.
Mm.
Not only did my parent, my mother, but my the teacher that we had, they all sort of protected us.
Mm.
You know, they wanted us to be to act as children as much as we could under the circumstances, because everybody knew that this was a very unusual situation. So, but they themselves didn't really know what was going on. Nobody knew.
Right.
If you were in a transport, that your chances of survival when you arrived there was almost less than 1%, you know?
Wow.
So that's what the story was. So we, as children, we concentrated on camaraderie, you might say, between the boys that I was living with. And you know, I sang in this, I don't know if you know the opera, called Brundibar. Have you heard of that?
No.
Yeah, Brundibar is an operetta for children, and it's being played all over the place now. And so I sang in the chorus, and I also sang in Carmen, in the first act of Carmen, where they have a children's chorus. So I sang in that, and so we played soccer a lot and things like that. So we try to be, you know, as much children can be under these circumstances.
So, Michael, you mentioned at the beginning that this book came out of this memorabilia collection that you donated to the American Holocaust Museum.
Right.
And how were you able, how was your mother able to keep all of these things?
Well, in Tennessee, you were able to do it. You put it under the mattress or something like that, and that's how you keep it. If you were on a transport and you went to Auschwitz, you lost it all. It was absolutely, it was all gone.
Wow.
I have a friend here, a neighbor, who also comes from Czechoslovakia, and he kept a diary every day of his life. And so he kept a diary in Terezin, but then he was sent to Auschwitz. And, of course, the diary was confiscated with everything else he had. And he was not able to really keep a diary when he was in Auschwitz and he was in other camps. It was in Mauthausen, and he was on a death camp, you know, death march. And so when he came back out of that, he sat down and reconstructed everything. And the reason why I mention it is because it finally... He didn't want to talk about this either for many, many decades. And now, finally, that he's retired, he finally decided to have this diary translated from Czech into English and German and have it published and disseminated.
Mm.
And so that's how some of that was able to be saved. You know, but in my case, my mother's case, she was able to... save these pieces of paper and put them under the mattress, her mattress, and then when we were liberated, she put it all together and made an album out of it.
Now, a year or so ago, we interviewed the son of a Holocaust survivor who wrote his memoir, The Boy on a Wooden Box. Are you familiar with that story?
Yes, I heard about it. It's a very popular book.
Yeah, Leon Lason, and it's, you know, he would have been probably about the same age as you, and he was saved by Oscar Schindler. You know, that was and it doesn't sound like Prague had any Schindlers there.
right.
Yeah.
Although this Dutch artist that was my mother's boss, he was. He was asked to make a list of about 10 people in his department, and I think my mother was on that list, and another friend of my mother's was on that list, and those people were all saved.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, he made a list of 20 people, and then the German said, no, he can't have 20, you have to make it 10. So then he made it 10.
Wow. Well, Michael, thank you so much for sharing this with us today on Writers' Voices, and also for sharing your story with the world.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and I hope it goes well.
And that was Michael Gruenbaum with Somewhere There Is Still a Sun. Welcome back to Writers' Voices, and we're going to continue talking about the Holocaust today. We just had an interview with Michael Gruenbaum, who had written his memoirs of his childhood in Czechoslovakia and in concentration camp, Somewhere There Is Still a Sun. And now we have with us in the studio Dennis Raimondi, who knows quite a bit about the Holocaust and Holocaust memoirs. Dennis, how did you become interested in this subject?
Well, what happened with me is, you know, obviously, like many people, I've read about the Holocaust, and I was born in 1949, so it was before my time, but certainly part of my parents' time. And, you know, I thought I knew quite a bit about it. But then I interviewed a person from my radio show, Speaking Freely with Dennis, Arthur Berger. I just, you know, I'd like to go into different topic areas, and he's one of the head people at the United States Memorial Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And so I interviewed him, and it was very interesting. He talked about the museum and what its function is. And then a few months later, I watched this documentary that got the Academy Award a couple of years ago about a woman who was over 100 years old who was a Holocaust survivor, and she played the piano, and it was an interesting story. So then I thought, you know, I'd be fascinated to hear some of the stories of Holocaust survivors who are now mostly well into their 80s and their 90s. They're quite on in years. So I called Arthur Berger and I asked him about at the museum and about it. He thought it was a great idea because they want to preserve as much as they can and get as many stories as they can. Obviously, they have a lot of footage and all. So we went back and forth, and then he put me in touch with the head of survivor affairs at the museum, and that person got me about a dozen survivors from Holland, from France, from Czechoslovakia, from Albania, from every area that you could imagine. And everybody's story was very different. And it was very sad and very inspiring. And it was probably the most rewarding radio experience I've had.
So you were collecting oral histories, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Have there been other people who have done that with Holocaust survivors?
Oh yeah. I mean, they have. The series I did has now been donated to the Holocaust Museum, and it's part of their permanent audio collection. But they have, I'm sure, thousands and thousands of hours. I think Spielberg, the director, producer, he did a lot of documentation. So that's a big part of what they do. But I think the unique angle that I had when I did it was I was getting the stories of people toward the end of their life.
Mm.
And so what their perspective was after 60 years. And it was interesting. You know, I mean, every person was very happy to tell their story, even though stories were quite heavy. And they all wanted these stories to be preserved so that a Holocaust to any group of people, a genocide never takes place again. So they were very committed to this. One woman I interviewed, she's 88 and she still travels all over the world talking about it. I wanted to read, I got a letter from the museum in regard to the radio station, and I just wanted to read this brief paragraph.
Sure. What is the title of your series?
Well, if you go to my website, dennis.tv, and you go under series, it'll be, I think, just titled Holocaust Survivors.
Okay.
So this is from Dear Mr. Raimondi, this is from the museum. On behalf of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, I would like to thank you and KRUU for your donation to the permanent collection. That's right. We are grateful that you have sought to safeguard this piece of Holocaust history with us. You have helped us fulfill one of our most critical priorities, rescuing the evidence. We are in a race against time to collect as much authentic material as possible during this remaining window of opportunity. It's a remaining window of opportunity, and that was from Sarah Bloomfield at the museum. Because these people are getting older and they'll pass. And there are people out there that are Holocaust deniers that actually say
what
it's
you...
never... Well, I think that, you know, with the internet and anything, you can get people to believe anything, but it's absolutely insanity. And I challenge anybody who's a denier to come on the radio to me and I'll rip them to shreds with evidence. I grew up, you know, I had friends who's lost family members in the Holocaust. And I used to work at a swimming pool in New Jersey where several of the older people came in and they had the numbers on their arm and all the tattoos and that came from being in a concentration camp. And let's not forget, I spoke to survivors. Most people didn't survive. And even some of those that lived were so damaged by the Holocaust that their lives were very limited. But many folks had incredible resiliency and were able to survive. And I agree. I mean, these stories have to be told so history does not repeat itself.
Well, Michael Gruenbaum, the author we spoke to earlier today, said that in Czechoslovakia, 140,000 Jews were sent to Terezín. 90,000 of those were transported to the east, of which only about 1% survived. Of the ones that stayed at Terezín, 35,000 perished there for various reasons,
right,
and only about 15,000 survived. Mm-hmm. So,
6 million. Many countries like Poland were devastated. There were some stories that were inspiring. For instance, I don't think anybody I know knows what happened in Albania during World War II, during the Holocaust. And I actually want to bring a film in regard to that. And also, I can't remember the woman's name. One of the Holocaust survivors that I interviewed came from Albania. And Albania did more to protect the Jews during the Holocaust than any other country, as did Denmark. Denmark had a small Jewish population. It was about 7,000, but they worked an arrangement very quietly, clandestinely, with Sweden. And 99% of Danish Jews were saved because they were boat-lifted to Sweden before the Germans could get them. Mm. It was a small, but most people, and this is one of the lessons of the Holocaust, most people did nothing, and many people actually, under pressure or whatever, helped the Germans. So it was, you get a glimpse at how dark it can get and how deep humanity can sink in a very gloomy, bad direction. So, you know, you have to be aware of that so that you can prevent those things from happening again. And as one survivor said to me, look, this whole Holocaust could have been prevented. Things could have been done. So it's what steps you take now that prevent what happens in the future. And there have been Holocausts since then. Rwanda, you know, I've been to Cambodia where 2 million people were killed. And it's unfortunate that history does repeat itself.
Well, there's Holocaust happening in the Middle East right now. I mean, in some sense.
A lot of people are being killed. ISIS is going in and slaughtering people. We may not know what really happens until after it happens.
Yeah.
So I think human beings do have a responsibility to stop it. And, you know, who's going to take responsibility, which country, who's going to do what, that stuff that's argued over. But I think the earlier you act and to prevent these things from happening. And I think one of the things you can do is educate people, let people know that these things did and have happened. And if anybody is a denier in regard to it, they should be confronted.
Well, now, you know, both Michael and another man I interviewed, well, I interviewed his son, Leon Layson, who wrote The Boy on the Wooden Box, which was published right before his death. both of them did not talk about their childhood experiences for many, many years. It's not until they were quite old that they were able to talk about that. Did you find that with the survivors that you interviewed, that many of them didn't talk about it for a long time?
I don't know what they did at first. The way I got the people, the interviewees, the people I interviewed, was the woman in charge of survivors for the museum. There's about 80 survivors that they actually actively work with. And everybody had, I had one woman whose family hid in an apartment for 4 years in Holland. Another family that was in Eastern Europe, and they were also hidden by a group of farmers. I had a woman who was in Warsaw and witnessed the uprising of the in the Jewish ghetto there, where they actually fought the Germans, and they held the Germans at bay for longer than the entire Polish army did when they were invaded. Albania, and every sort of story. But whether or not they started telling those stories early on or not, I don't know.
We tend to favor the stories where there's a non-Jewish hero or heroine who's helping them out.
Yeah.
The Anne Frank or the Schindler, Schindler's List and so forth. But like you said, in many cases, no one helped.
Most people did nothing. You have to understand, like one woman in Albania, she and her mother and family members were protected by an Albanian family. But she said, you have to understand, that family would have been killed on the spot if they knew they were hiding Jews. And we all can say, this is what we would do, this is what we wouldn't do, or we don't know what we would do. I'd like to think I would do that, but I don't know. It's very, very easy to say, oh, yeah, sure, I would do that. But when a gun is pointed at your head, who knows what you will do and how you will act. And I think that is the haunting thought that I have from it, hearing these survivors. What would I have done? Would I let this happen again? How many of us hear a anti-Semitic or a racist remark and we don't do anything about it? That's where we should question ourselves. We should not ever let anything like that pass. And that's the way to stop it, not let it get started. But it's sitting back and not feeling it's your problem, that it's other people's problems, and that's how those things build. So, yeah, it's very thought-provoking and haunting.
We're speaking with Dennis Raimondi today here on Writers' Voices about the series that he did for Speaking Freely with Dennis on Holocaust survivors. Another, people sometimes say, well, why didn't they just leave before things got really bad? Because
that's a good question.
Yeah, the rule, the edicts, all the laws restricting Jews came in gradually.
Right. Well, let me address that, because that was one of the areas that I asked almost every survivor I interviewed about. And this was also very eye-opening for me. I said, what was it like in Vienna? What was it like in Yugoslavia? What was it like in Holland? What was it like even in Germany before the crackdown, before the Germans came? And they said, life was pretty normal. We had a good business, and, there was talk, and did you grow up with anti-Semitism? And many people said a little bit, but really that wasn't noticeable. We were thriving. Everything seemed fine. And then almost like overnight, in some cases literally overnight, everything changed. So it's easy to say, oh, yeah, they should have gotten out. Think about it. Yeah, you have a business. Your family's been developing for 200 or 300 years. Then, you hear some stuff and you think, oh, let's get out of here. The people that got out. When they saw how bad it was and how people were desperate, and they escaped and did whatever they could. But most people were trapped and they didn't see it coming. It's like somebody says, hey, a storm's coming. Well, we've heard that a lot, And then all of a sudden the tornadoes are ripping through town. There's no way to know when it's really going to hit and how hard.
Plus, I think it was, I don't know if the Nazis did this intentionally, but they did put the restrictions in a little bit at a time so that I think in The Boy in the Wooden Box, he talks about that they kept thinking, well, if this is as bad as it gets, you know, this is okay. We can handle this. If this is as bad as it gets. And every time, and it was just a little more, a little more, a little more. And that was also, I think, how they convinced the non-Jewish population. Because if they had come in and been really, you know, put everything, all of the terrible things, if they'd happened all at once, people might have reacted to it. But because it was so gradual, you got kind of used to, well, first, oh, that's not so bad. Okay, so what, they can't go to the swimming pool. You know, that's no big deal. Yeah. So it was little by little until they got used to thinking it was no big deal.
Well, let's look at current times. I mean, or recent history. You know, you had even after the Emancipation Proclamation, even in this century, even not 50 years ago, there was segregation. That could have gotten, you know, where does it go from there? Nobody knows. It's where you live. It's what you stuck with. And also, I think what happened in Germany, what they did, and I see this happening today here in America. You take a group of people, you demonize them, you blame everything on them, and then say, okay, let's round them up. It sounds familiar to me from what some of the presidential candidates are saying.
Yeah,
and
really.
So it's a let's, and then what, you know? I don't think the German people or anybody knew what the final solution, what that plan was. And even people when they were putting on the trains, eventually it leaks out. And you wonder, what did the American... what did the British intelligence know about what was going on? Why didn't they bomb the tracks and prevent the flow of people to the camps? Did they know? We may never know the answers to all of that, but everybody has to take some responsibility and look at it and really examine in their own heart and their soul what goes on today and what am I responsible to do? So So I think that look at, and again, Rwanda, Cambodia. Did anybody see it coming? No, I don't think so. And it happens fast, and it happens severely. And most
of
the world,
you can see the signs if you look.
Most of the world said, "Look, let's be real. Pol Pot was given protection from the United States. He was the mastermind. He was the reason for the genocide in Cambodia. But since he was anti-communist, he died. He was never imprisoned. I don't think, you know." He lived and died, even though he committed great crimes against humanity. So, you know, we all have to examine ourselves. We all have to feel part of the responsibility of whatever takes place. What did we do? What didn't we do? You know, so, when you think about these things, it's haunting, and it makes you really go inward and internalize and experience this. And I think there's nothing better than hearing the voices of the people that actually went through it.
Dennis, were all the survivors that you interviewed living, did they all emigrate to the United States?
No. Yes, eventually everyone I talked to is currently living in the United States, yeah.
And did they have anything to say about, you know, about things here and how that transition to living in America was?
We didn't talk about that. But everyone emphasized that they didn't say this should never happen again to the Jewish people. What they said is this should never happen again to anyone. And we have that responsibility. They feel that's their message. And, you know, they say never again, never again. And they said a genocide of any sort toward any people should never happen. The world should not stand by and allow it to happen. So that was a universal message. And everybody had a very different story. And
are there any personal stories that really stick out in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, the stories that stick out are always the ones where people experienced some goodness from other people. I'll give you one story. It was maybe two. There was a family, and it was a husband, wife, and a son and daughter. So it's a family of four, two young kids, and they had friends. They sort of knew what was happening. They had to go into hiding. So they went to friends, and they said, can you hide us? They had a farm. Now, again, these friends, You hide us, you get caught, you and your kids are going to get killed. Everybody, you know, there was no, they took no prisoners, the Germans. So at first the mother said, yes, we'll take you in. Then the father came home and he said, look, we can take in the mother and daughter, but if we take, and we can tell them they're cousins, we can make up a story, but if if we take the son and husband, since they're circumcised, and only Jews were being circumcised then, pretty much in Europe, then we can't take them. So I get choked up telling the story. So then the husband, the Jewish family, they accepted that, and the mother and daughter hugged the brother and father and was saying goodbye to each other. And then the father, the Christian father, or I don't know if he was Christian, but the family that was hiding them, he just said, no, we'll take you all. And they built like in the barn. These people were underground for a couple of years. And the only time they could come out was when the bombings were happening at night. So they survived, and it was, and I think they stayed in touch with his family, and his family was honored in Israel. And so that was a good story. But I don't want to overemphasize the good stories, because, like I said, what we really should know is that most people did nothing. And what we should all ask ourselves is, what would we do? Would we take a risk? Would we do what the good folks did? Or would we stand by and do nothing?
And honestly, you can find situations today where you can actually act on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it starts with, if you're in a conversation with people, if you're around friends or family, and somebody makes a remark that's against a group of people or even a person, a racial remark, an anti-Semitic remark, a remark about Mexican Americans or any other group, don't tolerate it. Step up into the plate and say, don't say that around me. It really shocks people when you do that. And I think we've all had situations where we didn't say anything and later on we wished we had.
And I just want to say, if you say, I'm not racist, but
yeah,
you are racist.
Yeah. Because it's that whole thing, you know. You really have to think, and you know, we're seeing it happen in Europe now. I was in Europe with flow of immigrants coming in from mostly from Syria and other countries. These people are desperate, and then you see places that I must say I was in Sweden and Germany. Those are the two countries that open their doors, but Denmark, Norway, Finland, most of Europe, Hungary. You didn't even want them coming through. So, and it's because people want to protect their way of life. You can understand it, but if your neighbor's house is burning down and you don't do anything about it, and you don't let them in your house because they're desperate, then you're a creep. You know, sorry, I mean, that's the way it is. And so we're seeing that. And it's complicated. Each situation is different. And I don't want to judge people, because, like I said, each situation is different and complex. But I think people have to make a decision as to what they'll tolerate and what they won't tolerate.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today, Dennis. And if you're interested in listening to those stories from Holocaust survivors, go to
Dennis.tv, not Dennis.tv.com. There's no .com. It's just Dennis.tomvictor.tv.
Look and, for series.
And on the front page, it'll have, archives and all. Then there's one little section that says series. And one of the series is I think it's just simply called Holocaust Survivors.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.